Matthew chapter 22. Please find your way there. One of the mistakes that so many of us as Christians make is we just hop right into a verse or a passage, read it, and then try to interpret it. One of the best methods of avoiding that mistake is to know what's going on. Matthew, Mark, Luke, Paul, John, in the Revelation, all of those books, even in the Old Testament as well, they're not just simply little units broken up for our to make us feel good, to have devotional thoughts. Now, we can gain a lot from just a verse by itself in isolation, or perhaps even a passage. But if you want to really understand what the Bible is actually saying, you need to understand what's going on. We're going to begin here, and again, Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, He's speaking to who? Where? When? All of those questions are very, very essential if we're going to understand what he's talking about. This is either Tuesday or Wednesday of the Passion Week. At this point, the ones that he is looking to and speaking to the most are the religious leaders in the temple complex area. Things are progressing very rapidly toward the cross. Jesus is being confronted by them. He is confronting them. He's already been telling parables that they've put the two and two together that he's speaking about us. He's indicting us with these stories. So that's where is the temple area. When Tuesday or Wednesday, maybe Tuesday of Passion Week, and to whom is he speaking? Well, there's people listening. There's all kinds of folks around, undoubtedly. But he's speaking primarily to the religious elite, the scribes. Those are the scholars, the lawyers. Now, lawyers are not attorneys. They are experts in the Old Testament law, the law of Moses. There's also the Pharisaical party. Who are they? Well, they are individuals, much more in number than the Sadducees, but nevertheless, they are groups of people who are trying very, very hard by their efforts and their own self-righteous approach to, in their minds, please God and to satisfy God's righteous requirements. They're arrogant. They're prideful. They look down upon other people who don't have the same kind of scruples as they do. And there's a goodly number of them. And also there's the Sadducees. Now, a much smaller religious group, but this group is the powerful ones. They usually are wealthy, or they were wealthy. They also were a favored group by the Romans. As a matter of fact, the high priest would always be a Sadducee. There's theological differences that are quite significant. The Pharisees, for example, and their scribes, they believed in the resurrection on the last day. They believed in angels and demons, and they believed in the judgment to come. And so they had that framework. Now, the Sadducees, they rejected supernatural. In a sense, they did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. They did not really even seem to think much about life after death. And they rejected supernatural beings. You know, demons, angels, just for the superstitious, just for the weak-minded. So you have that kind of dynamic going. There's another group that's not religious necessarily, and I don't know if they had any religious scruples or particular beliefs, other than they were called simply the Herodians. Now, the Herodians were Jews, but they were supportive of the Herod dynasty. Herod the Great, followed by Herod's sons, Herod's region that he ruled after his death was divided up among his surviving sons. And they also had Roman support and favor. And you have, so those are the people that are here. So Jesus is going to tell another parable. Now, the parable is very, would be very familiar if you and I lived in that day. We have all kinds of things to occupy our time. There's all kinds of things. You can go to movies. You can go to ball games. You can go, you all kinds of things to take up your time. However, in that day, there were two really primarily social events: weddings and funerals. Those were the biggies. Now there were things like synagogue on the Sabbath and that kind of thing. The different festivals they would go to on feast days. And observances and whatnot. So Jesus is going to tell a parable. And it's going to have to do with something that makes sense. It would have made sense to them, at least. He says, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son." Okay. Now, we obviously identify the reference here. The king, of course, is God. The son, of course, is Jesus. But he's not telling the story that where it's readily understood by those listening. They're just hearing the story. And he says, "And he sent his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding feast, but they would not come. And he sent other servants, saying, 'Tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered. Everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast.' But they paid no attention and went off, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his servants, treated them shamefully, and killed them." Now, before we get to the response of the king, a little bit more maybe background of what is being implied here. A king. Do you tell a king no? You see, what would probably have taken place would have been first that the king would have sent out notice that there's going to be a wedding. His son is going to be married. It's going to be a very festive time. It's going to be a major celebration. And he sends out invitations. And then when the time is right, when it's ready, then what takes place? The king sent out his servant saying, "The time is now." He said that, the fatted calf and have been slaughtered, and my oxen have been slaughtered. Everything is ready. Come. It's time to come. He's ignored, and it's more than just a simply slap in the face kind of thing. It's much more degrading than that. What happens? Well, he's not only ignored. One guy goes to his farm, other to his business. And then some of the others, well, they treat that messenger very shamefully and even take his life or their lives. Now, what's going to happen? Well, you know what's going to happen. What is the king going to do? Well, he's ticked. And rightfully so. He's been not only insulted, but so has his son been insulted. He also has been... this been treacherous. It's treason on behalf of those who were invited who refused to come. So his response is verse 7, "And the king was angry, and he sent his troops and destroyed those murderers and burned their city." That is not an overstatement. That's what kings would do, things like that, if they were offended to this degree. "Then he said to his servants, 'The wedding feast is ready, but those invited are not worthy. So, go out into the main roads, invite to the wedding feast as many as you find.' And the servants went out into the roads and gathered all who they found, both bad and good, so the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to look at the guests, he saw there was a man who had no wedding garment. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding garment?' And he was speechless." Now, again, I'm going to pause for a moment. If you're going to have a feast, if you're going to have a celebration, you need people. That's just you know, you want them there. So those that were invited refused to come. As a matter of fact, they refused in such a strong way that they were very insulting in their refusal to come. So the servants went out on by order of the king. You find whoever you can. And you bring them, I want my wedding hall filled. Luke adds a little few of those details. So what happens is, so they come, they go out, and then you can, now this is implied, and it's not stated, it's implied. Probably the king himself is the one that's providing the wedding clothes. The robes, the clothing that the people would need to be wearing. I would doubt if people who are very poor would have suitable clothes to come to such a event. So they come to the event, they have wedding clothes. And then there's this turn in the story. There's a man there that does not have them on. If my assumption is correct, that the king is the one providing the clothing, then why was this man not appropriately attired? The only thing it could be is he did not accept it or he refused it and came on in anyway. King doesn't know who his guests are, so he comes out to see them, to meet them. Remember, it's whomever they could find. It's not those who were invited. It's people he had, may have never have met. Now they're here for the celebration. And they go out and, he sees this one man. He is not appropriately attired. So the king responds in verse 12 by calling him friend. But the idea of friend is he's not saying it friend in a sense of, hey buddy, my, you know, come and hang out with me. Now, not a friendship kind of thing, but maybe more of a polite, you know, a polite greeting to him, not knowing who he is or anything like that. How did you get in here without a wedding garment? There's no response. There's no response that can be offered. Assuming again that I'm not off base by making the claim that perhaps the king himself, through his graciousness, which I think is appropriate, provided the wedding clothes. Why was this man not wearing them? There's nothing he can say. There's no response he can make. He's speechless. Then the next part, verse 13, then the king said to his attendants, bind him hand and foot and cast him in an outer darkness in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Followed by verse 14, for many are called, but few are chosen. Now, there's a lot of ways that we could approach this, to be sure. But we need to remember, to whom is he speaking? Anybody remember? Basically, you just categorize that he's speaking primarily to the religious elite in the temple area. Priests, those kind of folks. Pharisees, Sadducees, etc. That's who he's speaking to. We've already seen that the religious elite, religious leadership, maybe is a better way of saying it, they've already rejected Jesus. They've done that. They've rejected God's kingdom. They've even rejected God himself. And Jesus is pointing that out. So in this parable, he is definitely pointing the finger right back at the religious leadership, saying, you were invited to the kingdom by the king himself, and you have rejected that offer. You have rejected that offer. Because of your rejection, you're not going to see it. You're not going to experience it. You're not going to live under in the kingdom of heaven. You're just not going to be there. And Jesus' words at times are so focused on that, you can understand why the religious leadership became so irate at him. When he would talk to a self-righteous person, believing that that person believing that he was special in God's sight because he kept the law as clearly and as completely as humanly possible. And in the middle of that, Jesus says to them, tax collectors and prostitutes, the two lowest class, they're going to enter the kingdom of heaven before you do. You don't win friends and influence people with that kind of talk. And that's what Jesus, he's pointing it to them. You were invited, but you did not consider yourself worthy. So God is going to extend an invitation to others that are going to come. Assuming, again, that my implied the king is offering the wedding garment, one man slips in, and he doesn't have one. The king immediately notices that and just simply calls him, why are you here without a wedding garment? There's no response. And then there's judgment. Now, those who have rejected the kingdom, the religious leadership of the Jews, now have excluded themselves. Now, there's a man here in the middle, or in the midst of this wedding feast, that doesn't belong there. When he is confronted, he has nothing to say. Now, I want to back up just a bit from that text and begin thinking about it in a little bit broader theological terms. I've heard and read individuals make comments like, you know, if there is a God, I can't wait for the opportunity to stand before Him and ask Him to give me answers and reasons why things are the way they are. In other words, thinking that they have some kind of moral authority to call God into question. I don't think there'll be any of that. I don't think anyone that claims that they want to ask God and accuse God of why is there evil in the world? Why did so-and-so get sick? Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Why are these bad things? All that kind of thing. As if they're somehow more moral superior than even God is. I don't think anybody's ever going to be able to, will ever be able to speak. You see, I think, and I believe, that a lot of people, what they believe is in a God that is very, very small. They have no concept of who God is. They just don't. They have not the true concept of who God is. They have a caricature in their minds they're comfortable with. And they think somehow that God isn't just a couple of notches above them. And maybe they have some moral right to call God into question. I want you to understand something. The response that people are going to make is going to be the response that Job made. Job had throughout, as you watch through the book of Job, you read through it, you have the cycles of speeches. And Job, at times, is very impatient. He wants to know now, why has all this tragedy happened to me? And so there are times he's asking questions that, if God could just speak to me and sort this out. And then you get to chapter 38 in Job. You go through all the cycles of speeches of his three friends, of Job's responses, and then God does show up. God answers no questions. God is not going to answer questions. He tells Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the world? And there's a whole series of questions that God asked Job And Job, what's Job's response? Anybody remember? He is speechless. There's nothing he can say, and there's nothing he wants to say. I come back to this. I think this also is indicative of that particular kind of, for our understanding. We don't, even us as Christians, have such a small view of who God truly is. We're not overwhelmed with the awesomeness of who He is. We're not fearful. As a matter of fact, the prophets would point out, there is no fear of God before their eyes. That's the Hebraic way of saying. Jeremiah points out, they don't even blush when they sin anymore. Well, this man has no reply. So the command was, okay, he tells his attendant, bind him hand and foot, cast him to outer darkness, in that place where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. Interesting phraseology, to be sure. It's not the only place it's going to appear. It's going to be in other places, too. The interesting thing, though, is the statement of outer darkness. Is it a metaphor? Because sometimes we talk about this place of being a place of torment, of fire, brimstone, those kind of images. I think all the images are very helpful to understand. Earlier in Matthew, Jesus said, if your right eye caused you to sin, what should you do? And if your right arm, cut it off. It's better to be maimed entering into the kingdom than to have both eyes and all your faculties and be cast into hell. He's pointing out that hell is so bad, you need to do whatever you can to avoid it. The problem is you can't do anything to avoid it other than what Jesus has done in our stead. Okay? So this guy is cast into a place. Here's called outer darkness. There's Old Testament imagery here. All right? One of the things that is sad is how little of the Old Testament so many of us Christians are aware of. Because the backdrop of the New Testament is the Old Testament. And there was, you need to think of it in these terms. This is helpful. When the children of Israel are leaving Egypt, they go into the wilderness. And it's not forests. It's arid places. It's dangerous. It's in a lot of respects. There's not enough food. There's not enough water. They would not survive if it were not for God's own supervision of their experience wandering around the desert. But it's a place. It's a place of chaos. Not order, but chaos. It's also a haunt of demons. You may not come across, be aware of this, but there were, when it came to sacrifice, especially on the Day of Atonement, there were two goats. There were two to be sacrificed for the nation. There was one goat that would actually be sacrificed. It would shed its blood. It would die. It would be burnt offering. The other goat was the scapegoat. It was one that was symbolic and carrying all the sins of the people. So what do you do with all that sin? Well, you send it out into the desert. You send it out to Azrael, a demon. And sometimes the name Azrael is translated, other times into something else. But other times it may, some translators will actually just keep the name in the Old Testament. You send it out there. Where does sin belong? Well, it belongs outside the camp, out there. Are you with me so far? Okay? You send it out. So they send it out. Out where it belongs. Outside of the camp. Now, if someone was being banished, if someone was leprous,
They would have to be quarantined outside of the camp. The problem with being outside of the camp is you're vulnerable. You're no longer enjoying the protection of the people. So you need to get this symbolism in your mind. When someone was not being executed but being banished, they were put outside the camp. They were now outside the safety of the camp. In 1 Corinthians 5, you have Paul doing the same thing. But what you have there is you have a man that is living with his stepmother in an immoral relationship. Nobody's doing anything about it. Paul is scolding the Corinthians that even the pagans don't allow that kind of thing. And you do? Put him out. But you think about what he's saying. Take him from being within the people of God, put him outside. And what's going to happen to him outside? What does Paul say? Put him out where Satan is. And Satan will destroy his flesh. Put him out. You have the same imagery. Now, I say all that background to come to this, what he's saying here. Where are you going to take this man? Well, you take him from the safety of the people. In this sense, the people of God. You take him from there, and you take him, you put him out in a place where there is no spiritual protection. There is no safety. Because you put him out that way. And when that happens, he's in a very, very bad place where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. I hope some of that helps to kind of broaden your thinking a bit about how serious. Now, Christians today don't understand this at all. That's why there's so many, quote, professing Christians, end quote, that never go to church. It's no big deal to them. They're not involved with the people of God. You know, they've got other things to do, other priorities. So they really don't find themselves really needing to be a member and a part of a congregation. You know why? They don't think you need it. They don't realize that if you are not in with the people of God, you are vulnerable spiritually. Extremely vulnerable. Because that's where chaos is. That's where Azarel rules. And you better be careful. Because you're going to be very vulnerable. You have no spiritual protection. We sometimes want to separate the Old and New Testament with such a clear line that we don't understand that today, yeah, Israel is still God's chosen people, but now God has another family, the church, in a big sense, of churches, of Christians who are people who have come together to form the people of God. And not to be a part of that, you're in a very, very dangerous place. Very dangerous. In other words, there's safety in the camp. All right? So this man is cast out. And then we come to this verse, and I'm going to approach this verse with fear and trepidation. For many are called, but few are chosen. We need to be careful. I know where we can go real quickly. And I'm not necessarily wanting to get into, you know, the Arminian Calvinist debate. And the reason I'm not going to get into that is simply because I don't fully understand it, to be honest. But what are we talking about here? Context is king. It rules. The idea of being called here is an invitation. That's what we're talking about. That's the context. So it's not the effectual calling that Paul writes about. It's not that calling. is, it's a, think of it more along the lines of God's invitation. Many are invited, but it's actually only a few. Comparatively speaking, only a few actually enter in. Now, I've given you a whole lot of stuff there, more than I probably should have, because we're going to get into the showdown, as it were, between Jesus and these religious leaders. Comments or questions? I'm sure I've sparked questions. Because most of the time we don't think about this Old Testament imagery that everybody there would have readily understood.
Is there a difference, Pastor? Early on, he was talking about the servants, and the servants did certain things. Of course, his army came to get the bad guys. But down here, verse 13, it says, the king told the attendants to tie him hand and foot. So it was just basically who was there at the wedding feast.
Or that the person who's attending to the king. It could be a synonym for servants. It's not necessary.
Would it equal the servants then?
It could. Okay. I would take it that way. It might have other connotations. I would take it more as a synonym to the servants, those that are attending the king. Not hey everybody, here's a guy, get him. No, not necessarily. So he tells this, and then he shifts to being challenged. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. All right, we're going to get you. We're going to get you to misspeak or say something controversial, and you'll lose a lot of the favor of people who are listening around you. And they sent their disciples to him, and this is great, along with the Herodians. Now we could read that and not really see much there, but believe me, there's a lot there. Pharisees and Herodians? The enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Herodians and the Pharisees did not see eye to eye. They did not at all, because the Herodians are political. Pharisees are religious. But both groups saw in Jesus a threat. So they said, okay, teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully. Now, any time somebody comes at you and starts padding it a little, you know, putting a lot of syrup on it, a lot of bread on the butter, you know something's up. You know something's up. So they're not pulling the wool over Jesus' eyes. So what goes on? It says, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us, then, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Have you stopped beating your wife? You know, it's one of those kind of gotcha. What are you going to say? Where's he at? Where's he at? The temple area, okay? The people there hate it, just like you. Hated paying taxes. Hated paying Roman taxes. So, what do you think, Jesus? Now, Jesus, he wants to win favor with the people. All he's got to say is, you know, I tell you about Caesar. I'm so sick of him. He lives in luxury. We live in poverty because he takes everything from us. No, Jesus didn't even go there. His response, if he responds no, then he's committing treason. If he responds yes, the people are going to say, oh my goodness, how could you even support such an injustice is what we're being forced to pay taxes to Caesar. So he points out in verse 18, but Jesus, aware of their malice, said, why do you put me to the test, you hypocrites? You come and tell me that I am the, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, and now you tell me you're trying to paint me into a corner. Show me a coin for the tax. And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, whose likeness and image is this? They said, Caesar's. Then he said to them, therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. That's bam! Now, I want to just unpack this just a little bit, and I'm not going to stay on it very long because I want to keep going here. This calls to memory something. He holds up a coin. Whose picture is on this? Whose image? Well, it's Caesar's image. It's a denarius. It's a Roman coin. Okay. Well, then if it's Caesar's picture and his inscription on it, give to Caesar what belongs to him. But he uses the word likeness. That's interesting. That the word likeness is the one used in this context. He didn't say image. He said likeness. And that immediately makes me think of something. Where in the New Testament, where in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 1, do you hear the word likeness?
In Genesis 1, God created man. He created him in his likeness.
Yes. So I think Jesus is saying more than simply pay to Caesar what it belongs to him. He says to him, therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's and belong to him. You belong to him. You're in his likeness, as the coin is in Caesar's likeness. When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. Like, duh, now what? Now what? Well, Pharisees struck out. Now the big boys. Here, they've got a ringer. They've got a ringer now. They don't believe in the resurrection, you remember. But they've got a ringer that probably left the Pharisees chewing their fingernails, trying to figure out how to respond because they don't know how to respond. And it's very good. It really is a good one. Unfortunately, they base it on a false premise. And the false premise is in the resurrection, marriage will continue as it is upon this earth. The same day, we're still in the same place, Sadducees came to him, who say that there is no resurrection. They ask him a question. Teacher, Moses said, and they're right, Moses wrote this, if a man dies and having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. That's because property rights were so important. So if a man died before having any offspring, any children, to inherit his property, then it was, Moses pointed out, that the procedure would be a close family member, i.e. a brother, would marry the widow. It'd be a legal marriage, but in that union, the children born would not be considered the heirs of the brother, but of the deceased brother. That was to protect property rights and inheritances. So they point out, this is what the law says, and it's right. That's exactly what the law says. Now, there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. So too the second and the third, down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. Bless her heart. She probably couldn't wait. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her. Okay. This is a ringer. So they thought. It probably had worked so effectively with those poor Pharisees, that they didn't know. They didn't know it was better wonder watch. They had no way of addressing this. All seven of these are legal marriages. All seven are. There's no illegitimate marriage here. So they all have married her legitimately, according to the law of Moses. All right, you got that in mind. Well, great. So in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? They're making the assumption, of course they don't believe in the resurrection, but if there were a resurrection, there's going to be seven men that have one woman. Okay, which one? Is it the first one? Is it the third, the last one? And Jesus, what Jesus says here, folks, this is the price of admission tonight. All right? It's just to get a hold of this. But Jesus answered them, "You're wrong." Bam! He told these intelligent, well-schooled, influential religious leaders, "Hey, you guys are wrong." He doesn't say, "Well, there's another interpretation that we could consider," or "there's this particular." He didn't say any of that. He just simply says it. "You're wrong. You're wrong." Okay. Why are they wrong? Well, because you do not know neither the Scriptures nor the power of God. You guys are, when I was a teenager, prior teenager, when somebody said something that was kind of silly, we'd say, "You're ignorant." That's ignorant. We didn't even say the word right. We just said the way we said it. They're ignorant. They may be PhDs, but they're ignorant. They don't know what they're talking about. "For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are not angels, but are like angels in heaven." Angels don't procreate. They don't marry. Genesis 6 is an exception to that, but they don't. By nature, they don't need to, because they are eternal creatures. They don't need to perpetuate the angelic species, as it were. They're like angels. Not that they are angels. That is just simply a false belief. It's worked its way into Christianity. That when someone, it's a wonderful life theology. And every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. Clarence was never to be an angel. All right? You got that, right? I love verse 31. I want you to notice the unique statement that Jesus makes. This is what I told you is worth everything that being here tonight. "As for the resurrection of the dead," now listen, I've got this highlighted right here. I don't want to miss it. "Have you not read what was said to you by God?" Okay, tell me what's curious about that. What's unique about what that verse says, or that portion of that verse?
They didn't believe in the resurrection.
Well, no, they didn't. Look at the verbs here. Read and said. "Have you not read what God said to you?" Well, yeah, that's it. The point, I guess, sometimes I think, well, anyway, I do not a very good job of getting it out there, I guess. You have a book in front of you, all right? God speaks. He has spoken. When you read those words, they are words that God has said to you. Like, wow. You see what Jesus is saying? Have you not read, there's the verb, what God said, there's another one, to you. That shows you something of how Jesus viewed Scripture. Not that is the contains the words of God. It is God speaking. We need that today. To get rid of all this slish-sloshy kind of Christianity where we see that, wait a minute, God has spoken. He said it. Whether we deal with the gay stuff, how to deal with that, or women in pastorates or preaching, how do you deal with all of these things? God said. He has spoken. Let's listen to what He said to us. Okay. And then to show you how important the Word of God is, every word of God, every word that God speaks, I should say it that way, Jesus bases the proof of life to come on a verb. A present tense verb. Look at verse 32. I am the God. Stop right there. You know, when was that stated? From the burning bush. Moses. Okay, Exodus 3. There you got it. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living. Jesus says there, without any need to clarify, it's very clear that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive when God spoke that originally. Now, their bodies are all dead, but Jesus is saying they are alive because God is the God of the living, not the dead. And so that two-letter word, am, is incredibly significant. You and I need to pay very close attention to what actually is being written, what actually is being stated, so we don't go off in tangents and miss the point. When the crowds heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. Why? Because he shut them up. They had heard probably for generations the Sadducees making fun of the Pharisees because of the belief in the resurrection, giving them a scenario they could not answer. And Jesus, with hardly any effort, shuts their mouths. Oh, wonderful. Well, but when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, remember, he's an expert in the Old Testament, he asked him, that is Jesus, a question to test him. So he's not really wanting to know the answer. He's wanting to put Jesus on the spot. They're striking out one after the other here. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And he said, Jesus did, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and the second one is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend or hang all the law and prophets. Take those two. Those two. If you obey those two, you satisfy the law. You satisfy it. Love God with all, your neighbor as yourself. That's that, remember I drew the cross? There you go. You got it. So, now, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. Turnabout's fair play here. You've been trying to confuse, and you've been trying to get me to commit myself to some sort of strange statement that you're going to exploit and all that kind of stuff. I got a question for you guys. And they ask, well, and Jesus continues, what do you think about the Christ, Messiah? Whose son is he? Well, that's an easy answer. This is really about a kindergarten level question for a Jew of that day. Of course. He's the son of David. That's what it says in the Old Testament. He's going to be a son of David. Messiah coming. He's going to be a son of David. Upon David's throne, he was going to have a descendant who would reign forever. That's the promise that God made to David. So, yeah, he's a son of David. He's a descendant of David. And then Jesus' response is, well, how is it then that David, in the Spirit, calls him Lord? Psalm 110, verse 1. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If David calls him Lord, how is he his son? I would have loved to see the wide eyes and the gaping open mouths of the Pharisees at this point going, they have no response. They know the scripture. They know what it says in Psalm 110. The Lord, Adonai, no, excuse me, it's Yahweh, says to Adonai, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Place them under your feet. How do you deal with that? They understood it to be a Davidic passage. But David says, the Lord said to my Lord. If that second my Lord is what was assumed to be a reference to Messiah, how could David call his future descendant his Lord? How do you do that? They had no idea how to do that. Because they had no idea to whom they were speaking. You see, they weren't speaking simply to a descendant of David. They were speaking to David's God. And they did not know it. All right, questions or comments? Come on, you got a good hard 30 seconds here.
How many times do you think they had used that example that was used right up here about the resurrection and the man with his wife, son, and they couldn't answer it? And Jesus tore them and left them breathless, and they thought, well, we've got it again. You know, we've done this so many times, nobody could answer this. But Jesus did.
It was that enigma that could not be answered. The conundrum of the people, they're just going, oh no. Jesus had no problem with it. Now, again, I want you to be aware of this, and then I'll let you go, okay? The when and the where of what's going on right now in Matthew's gospel is of the utmost importance. Jesus is not on a hillside in Galilee speaking to the multitude of people who have come to listen to him talk. He's in the temple area speaking to the religious leaders. And are you getting the flavoring of what he's saying, he's doing here? They're trying to trip him up. He's not even stumbling. He's having no problem with them. And then he asks them a question and he leaves them dumbfounded. When someone who thinks they know everything is stumped, it's funny to watch their reaction. Usually they get ticked off because they thought they knew everything. And Jesus just simply asked him a question. You know the scripture. You know what it says. The Lord said to my Lord, yeah, they knew it. Well, how can that possibly be David's son? How can the Messiah be David's son? And yet, at the same time, he's David's Lord. That's a good one, Jesus. I think I need to go home. I hear my wife calling for the supper time. You see. But the thing of it is, and we'll get to this more as we next week when we get to chapter 23. 23 is the chapter where Jesus lets the religious leadership, he indicts them for what they really are. And in doing so, to confront them on that level that he's going to, that's where we get into those woes. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! And then he indicts them in what they do. In so doing, he sealed his fate. The cross is inevitable now. Of course, they've been wanting to kill him for a couple years now. But he's went to Jerusalem and had a showdown with them. And they don't do very well. And they know it. So what do you do with a guy who's smarter than you are? And you still want to, you know, save face. What do you do with him? You kill him. Thank you. See you later.